was interesting during this whole Iran situation that's ongoing. Not only have we seen crypto do well, Bitcoin specifically do well and actually gain dominance whilst everything kind of collapsed.
The US is currently undergoing a very long-term erosion of the dollar as the global reserve currency. If you look at the COFA database by the IMF, 76% of global reserve banks were using the Bitcoin as a reserve currency, and that's now 55%. In my view, it was very much whales. They believe in this four-year cycle, which I think is kind of nonsense from a investment thesis perspective, $30 billion worth. That was being offset by these fund flows, these institutional investors and retail investors buying, but it wasn't enough. The UK is the 15th largest holder of Bitcoin in the world, so it has excess of this asset. So it certainly makes sense to make it a strategic reserve now. We are starting to see other governments consider that. Well, we've seen Mubadala, which is a sovereign wealth fund in Abu Dhabi. We've seen the Czech government do a test trade in it. We've seen Luxembourg consider it too.
Are there any kind of trends that you're noticing? What's more popular? What's less? Is it market cap weighted? You know, what are some of the things you can derive from the flows we're seeing with altcoins?
So,
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the All In Crypto podcast. I am your host, Rupert Pickering, and today I am delighted and excited to be joined by James Butterfill, the head of research at CoinShares, one of Europe's leading digital asset investment firms, and you're best known for tracking institutional sentiment through CoinShares' weekly digital asset fund flows report, and also digging into areas like Bitcoin mining and broader market structure. James, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, great. Thank you.
The pleasure is all mine. We could have spoke off camera, I think, all day long. And I would love to do that at some point. But let's maybe kick things off with a little bit about yourself. Some of my audience may not be familiar with who you are and what it is you do. Perhaps you could tell us your journey into the cryptocurrency space, you know, how you kind of ended up at CoinShares.
Yeah. Well, I've always been bit of a tech geek, I suppose. Built computers and sold them and overclocked them when I was a student back in the late 90s. And then I went into finance, and there I started using IT. I did computing and geophysics, a master's degree. And then I actually used tech to help create investment views. And so I became an investment strategist and a fund manager, worked the Queen's Bank, or the King's Bank now, Coutts, for many years. And it was there I started creating institutional grade investment baskets. And something I found most interesting was usually technology. And from there I left and I joined a company called ETF Securities, which doesn't exist anymore. It was sold. But it had at the time Europe's largest gold fund, gold ETF, or ETC technically, as they call it. And it was then I had a lot of clients asking me about Bitcoin. So back in 2015, I'd heard about it, but I didn't really take it that seriously. But I started, you know, when clients were asking, I thought, okay, I don't really know much about this asset. So let's figure out how to do that. So I built my own mining rigs. I bought some ASICs and some Antminers, and I also built my own GPU rigs for Ethereum. So I was mining both in my basement at home for a good few years. Didn't need to heat the house for quite a long time. I was spending a lot on electricity. And so I got into it that way. And then when ETF Securities was sold, there were some guys that I worked with there that moved to CoinShares. And CoinShares assets under management when I started were about 300 million at the time. And they were really trying to engage the institutional investor. And because of my background in that space, I ended up becoming head of research for them and started writing about it. And I think that, like, one of the big problems I found was at the time, sort of 6-7 years ago, people were very evangelical about Bitcoin and digital assets generally. And they weren't really that data focused. So I just felt that maybe if I can create some reports that sort of detail some quite sort of credible data on what people are doing, then perhaps you know, people would believe me a bit more in the institutional space about the asset class, rather than just trying to wax lyrical about it. And you know, I think the problem with the Bitcoin maxi group is quite often it's like a kind of cultish, it's like almost a blind faith. And I, from a research background, I like to have, you know, sort of graphs and charts and numbers to back up my claims. And I felt actually there's quite a lot missing in the space. So my first thing I wrote, started really writing regularly, well, I've done that since 2020, is the fund flows report. And that I think has got a strangely kind of quite large following now of people who originally were looking for kind of true credible numbers on adoption. And it seemed to kind of fill a gap in the market. So that's
how I would agree. Yeah, no, that was brilliant. I would absolutely agree. Every single Monday, one of the first things that I do every Monday morning is actually go and look at your report. And typically for me, one reason why I look at it for a number of reasons, to see what's being accumulated outside of just Bitcoin, but also I look at it against perhaps sentiment in the cryptocurrency space. You know, I guess I'm a kind of beacon for crypto sentiment, having the channel that I do, engaging with people on all social medias across the board. I mean, often when there's kind of doom and gloom sentiment, it's always interesting to me to see that perhaps flows don't match. Would you say that's because there's a different elk of investor that you can spot through acquiring crypto through these funds? Would you say that's why often we see this discorrelation with kind of retail sentiment and what's actually happening on a maybe institutional level?
I think, yeah, what you're articulating is, I think the thing about the flows is they aren't always a forward-looking indicator at all. But I think where they have, in my view, become most useful is understanding peaks and troughs in sentiment. When people are overly euphoric and perhaps buying too much, and when people become too negative, and those turning points, that delta in the flow. So when flows hit sort of $1 billion of outflows a week, but then the next week it's 500 million of outflows, the next week it's 200 million, that delta, that slow trailing off of outflows, that's quite often quite a good indicator for a near-term bottom for the market. And that's how I think maybe that's what you sort of pick up on it, you know, that sort of that turnaround. I mean, we've seen that. What's been really encouraging more recently is tying it in with the geopolitical crisis. And, you know, if you were to say to me, oh, I think there'll be outflows when Trump sends missiles at Iran, I'd say you'd probably be right. But I was really encouraging to see quite the opposite. People bought $1 billion worth of Bitcoin in the week, last week. So that's a really encouraging thing. It works. You might have some view on the market, and I think the flows acts as some sort of confirmation as to your view or not.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I absolutely want to get on to recent events. You know, we spoke about it a little bit off camera and some of the encouraging things we're seeing as it relates to Bitcoin, providing that lifeboat, becoming what you wrote about years ago, this kind of unique diversifier that's really going to catch fire and become ablaze. Before we get on to that, the cryptocurrency market, Bitcoin, has really been selling off since October the 10th. And we won't go into perhaps what did or didn't cause that. I think there's a lot of questions that still need to be answered. Do you think, from your point of view, watching these kind of fund flows on a daily, weekly basis, that the kind of decline we've seen in Bitcoin and the crypto space broadly has been represented through the kind of action you've seen with these funds? Do you think they're in sync?
To some extent, I think when you look after October, the price fell rapidly. We saw some outflows. And then people started believing that there was a bottom at 80,000. They started bottom fishing. They started, you know, we saw some pretty strong inflows. In fact, Q4 last year, we saw $3.5 billion of inflows. So people were bottom fishing, but they were wrong, I think, in hindsight. And I do think it's worth just touching upon what was causing it. In my view, it was very much whales. They believe in this four-year cycle, which I think is kind of nonsense from a investment thesis perspective. But you've only got a sample size of three in terms of halvings to go by. But it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And whales have sold since October the 10th, $30 billion worth. And so that was being offset by these fund flows, these institutional investors and retail investors buying, but it wasn't enough. And that's why I think in aggregate, we've seen the price fall fairly sharply, because these whales believed in that cycle. It started off as a trickle of outflows and really started accelerating, and it became a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But we're starting to actually see that those whales slow down in terms of their selling. And actually, we're starting to see ETF investors maybe offset that almost. And that's why I think we're starting to see that stabilization in price. So, yeah, I think you could have been lulled into a full sense of security at the end of last year saying, okay, ETF investors are buying, therefore it's the low. But it clearly wasn't. There were other things going on, particularly with whales, that saw that. But I think, you know, these kind of cycle events pinpoint, you know, there's the price rise and the price fall after the cycle. I don't really believe in it too much, but it certainly is self-fulfilling. So certain points in the cycle, it does tend to have an impact on price, like we've just experienced.
Yeah, for sure. It's amazing how many self-fulfilling prophecies there are in markets. People kind of preempt something and play into it and kind of cause it without there being really much of a fundamental driver for it.
I have a theory that there's a lot of techies in Bitcoin and crypto generally, as you would expect. And techies like to write programs to do stuff. And that includes writing investment strategies. And I think so that in the traditional world would just be a systematic trading theme of some sort, or even a lot of them are very, if they don't realize it, are very much momentum based as well, these themes. So, you know, I think Bitcoin's very chock full of those kind of people. And that's why you have that slightly self-fulfilling nature of the Bitcoin price at times, where actually fundamentally what's happening and actually what happens to the Bitcoin price could be quite different.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And what do you think, you know, if I was to ask you to guess or to take an educated guess on moving forwards, do you think we move and continue to move further and further away from this kind of very rigid four-year cycle that centers around the halving? Some people would state that there are business cycles that coincide with it that are, you know, focused around debt cycles and all this stuff. But do you think over time we continue to move away from this four-year cycle? And I say continue wrongly because we are following it. Like you say, self-fulfilling prophecy, it's happening. Are we going to move away from this? Hopefully,
right? It would make sense. And for full disclosure, if you'd asked me this question 6 months ago, I'd say, yeah, the four-year cycle theoretically is dead because, you know, there's a falling number of big whales that are influenced by this. There's an increasing number of institutional investors that look at a whole completely different set of metrics that I think are more based on the fundamentals of what the asset is rather than just a four-year cycle. You know, if you were to walk into a room and say, yeah, I've got this great investment theme and basically I've seen this happen three times in the past in this four-year cycle and it's going to happen again, you'd be laughed out of the room. But it did have a much greater impact than I thought it would. But I do think over time, and I fully expect now, because of what's happened this cycle, the same thing's going to happen a bit in another 4 years. But perhaps at that time it will be less, because we'll see a greater institutional participation who look at other things. So, you know, my view is that Bitcoin is what I describe as an emerging store of value or a non-sovereign store of value. It's not quite got the established identity of something like gold in terms of being a store of value, but it's establishing that. It is a very hard asset. And that is what I mean by that is it has a very finite supply, a very predictable supply. And that's hugely unusual, actually, much harder supply than gold, for instance. And for that reason, it does suggest that things like monetary policy, so when the Fed sets rates, they should theoretically at least have an impact on price. So when the Fed is cutting rates, as that's essentially printing more money, that tends to make harder assets look more attractive. And that's when Bitcoin should theoretically perform quite well. And then conversely, when we see the Fed become quite hawkish and hike rates, actually things like treasury start to look more attractive because, you know, it's a technically a harder asset than for that point in time than Bitcoin is. And so, you know, I do think as time goes on, actually monetary policy cycles and just broadly the economic cycle will have more of an impact, and actually geopolitics as well, as we see things like Iran happen and people are looking for alternative assets, non-sovereign assets. There's not much out there, actually. I think that those kind of events would really support Bitcoin too.
Yeah, no, we had a great, like I say, conversation sort of off air about that. I do want to bring that on air and talk about sort of what's going on right now, and that being an accelerant for Bitcoin. You know, it's accessible far more so than perhaps gold, and really can provide that lifeboat to people in need, but more broadly, people who are maybe thinking ahead, planning ahead. You know, they might think there's a kind of big disruption going on in the world now with Trump. Whether you like what he's doing or not, he's disrupting a lot of things. And people may look at the kind of monetary order and go, okay, well, this is changing. How do I hedge that? I think Bitcoin definitely finds itself as a contender as far as hedging your bets goes. And maybe we can speak towards how perhaps you see institutions and nations looking at Bitcoin right now and the opportunity that it could provide. You know, what if you were to pitch Bitcoin to, let's say, the UK? I know we spoke about that. How would you do that? Why do you think someone like the UK or somewhere like the UK needs to be interested in Bitcoin?
Let's talk about institutions first and governments.
Yes, sure.
I think, like, from an institutional perspective, I've seen attitudes towards the asset really change over time. So, you know, I run this survey, it tracks $1 trillion worth of assets, and we ask investors what their reasons for buying Bitcoin, what are the key risks, and a whole load of other things. And the reason why they're buying is evolving over time. And it demonstrates actually an improving understanding of the asset, more of this sort of hard, very hard assets linked to monetary policy type things, a geopolitical hedge, a monetary policy hedge. You know, a lot of people are saying, okay, well, what happens if QE all ends up, you know, the whole QE, QT experiment really ends up ugly, you know? So people are looking for insurance policies against that. And it's for the same reason, actually, gold's performed well as well, that debasement trade. And I think, you know, we've seen in the survey, 60% of responses 5 years ago being the reasons for buying Bitcoin being speculation. And now it's only 15%, 14% of responses. And actually what's now around 40% of the responses is diversification. And another 30% is access to distributed ledger tech. So there's been a big change in why people are buying. And I think that demonstrates a sort of a maturation in the understanding of digital assets. And it's incredibly encouraging to see that over time. And I can see that, I can, you know, say that to with confidence, you know, when I see clients on a more anecdotal level, I ask them why they're buying. And I've been pushing for this viewpoint for a long time, that actually it is this non-sovereign asset, this diversifier, is becoming the key reason. And they're going away doing running their own numbers and drawing actually very similar conclusions that we have, that it really works in a portfolio as a diversifier. That and this access to this new technology is the key reasons why institutional investors are buying.
Because it makes sense, right? I mean, there was a kind of piece put out on the sort of 60-40 standard portfolio playbook and how that's changing in this new world. And all of that seems to be amplified by everything going out. Perhaps safe haven assets. It was interesting during this whole Iran situation that's ongoing. Not only have we seen crypto do well, Bitcoin specifically do well and actually gain dominance whilst everything on Monday kind of collapsed into last week. We've actually seen yields climb higher. Surely on a geopolitical event, and I might have this wrong, you would see a flight into perhaps bonds, not the other way around.
You're opening up a can of worms here. In terms of, I think there's, I've written about this, and I'm going to come on to that piece you're talking about, the 60-40 piece, because, yeah, I'll come on to that. But I think the US is currently undergoing a very long-term erosion of the dollar as the global reserve currency. If you look at the COFA database by the IMF, 76% of global reserve banks were using the Bitcoin as a reserve currency back in the year 2000. That's now 55%. And it's just steadily down and down over time. So the US is losing its global reserve currency. And I think when you hear like some of the crackpot comments from Trump at times, it makes people worried. Also, I mean, Rumsfeld in the past has talked about the hegemony of the dollar. You make the dollar too hard to own, then people will look for other things. And that's what's happening now. You know, if you are to own a dollar bank account, you have to, you will quickly find out you have to fill out FATCA forms, and they're deeply invasive and very hard. So people are finding other ways of earning the dollar or earning Bitcoin, you know, and if Bitcoin's, if the dollar's being replaced, which we believe it is, that's why in this kind of instance, we're not seeing the same responses as you would have seen historically in terms of yields. People are deciding to own other assets. And I think Bitcoin is one of them. Maybe it's Chinese renminbi. You know, what replaces the dollar as a global reserve currency? I don't know. I mean, it's hard to see. I can't see it being the renminbi. I can't see it being SDR. I think it maybe it's a whole mixture of things, and that's perhaps why gold's done so well, and perhaps why Bitcoin's doing so well as well, that debasement trade. But onto your point about, you know, the 60-40 portfolio, this was actually my piece 6 years ago. I wrote about this. In exactly the 60-40 portfolio, the article I wrote was called A Little Bitcoin Goes a Long Way. And it was looking at 60-40 and saying, right, add 2-4% of Bitcoin, see what happens. And, you know, it, basically, you need only a very small amount of Bitcoin relative to, say, owning gold to have a really massive improvement in Sharpe ratio. So that's risk-adjusted returns. You need something like 10 times the amount of gold to have the same kind of effect as Bitcoin. And it's really encouraging to see in recent years a lot more institutions starting to publish on this point and see that. But this is something actually a lot of institutional investors in Europe in particular have got their heads around years ago. And it's only now starting to really sort of happen in the US.
And where do you think we are in regards to that kind of a little bit of Bitcoin goes a long way thesis, which, by the way, has been proven to be right? You know, there's a lot of recent publications on this stuff. Actually, you've been writing about this for 5-6 years, you know, when you originally published a lot of your papers that people are now catching up to. So an unbelievable insight there. Where do you think we are in regards to the trajectory of kind of everybody getting on board with this? You know, how much kind of uptake have we seen in regards to people diversifying with Bitcoin broadly? Probably quite hard to measure, but I'm sure there's a few signs.
I mean, in Europe, just anecdotally, you can say there's a lot of clients now engaged in discussions. That ones we had started off discussions with 2 years are starting now to consider it seriously. They spent age. I mean, there's been this image problem. You know, I remember people that we go to Germany and we say, let's have a meeting, and they take us to the coffee shop. They wouldn't take us to the main office because they're too embarrassed to say they've got crypto people coming to talk about. You know, that's been quite a common thing. So there is that reputational damage of saying, actually, hang on a minute, we should be looking at crypto. It's quite interesting. And that's been a very common thing amongst institutions. But that has gone away now. We don't see that. I mean, actually, we've had our first pension fund add, you know, the last bastion of risk, so to speak, has started adding a Bitcoin, a 1% Bitcoin position. And that seems to be the magic number now, is around, of the average is around 1%. So very cautious. But I'd say in terms of institutional participation, it's very low across Europe, very, very low in the UK in particular, because partly because of the FCA and the regulators, but also in the US, you know, they have this thing called the 13F filing data. And that's where any fund over 100 million has to divulge their holdings every quarter. And there we can see that it's still very much the domain of JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, and more on an advisory level they're doing it. So they're doing it for their retail clients. And then some select hedge funds, some market makers. And then we're starting to see like 3 out of the 8 university pension funds, like the Yale Endowment, there's the Delaware Fund, yep. and the Harvard. I don't think Yale now. I think it's the Harvard or the other. I get mixed up between the two. So there's three out of the eight now, small amount of Bitcoin on balance sheet. And I think that's a really encouraging sign, but I still think it's very early days yet. I mean, yeah, Bitcoin's, the ETF smashed the lights out. It saw $41 billion in 2024. I mean, that's more successful than any other ETF ever launched across any other asset class. You would then think, okay, well, everyone's got it, but they don't. The 13F data shows you that still very few people have it and in very small amounts. So I still would say it's early yet from an institutional adoption perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's this kind of avalanche, I think, still to come. And I think with everything going on, it's probably only going to accelerate that. You know, maybe we can come on to what's currently taking place right now before we maybe get to the crypto space more broadly and what you're seeing from a fund flow point of view. Maybe we can talk about what we're seeing right now happening in the Middle East again and how Bitcoin is reacting in all of this. And is it in a kind of accelerant or a kind of decelerant as far as adoption? I mean, it seems to be providing that lifeboat. It seems to be doing well when other things aren't. And I think back to what I mentioned about yields. I mean, I was kind of scratching my head on Monday going, okay, oil down, yields up, equity smashed, Bitcoin up. Is this an episode of Black Mirror? Or, I mean, what is going on here?
So this, I think you have to sort of look at it in context of what's happened to Bitcoin over the last 5 months as well. You know, since the 6:15 on the 28th of February, Bitcoin's massively outperformed other assets, partly because it's the only liquid instrument in town at the weekend. But even then, it sort of rallied. It initially sold off a little bit, which I wrote an article talking about terrorist events or black swan events and what happens and how does Bitcoin behave. And there's a whole load of them. There's yen carry trade collapse. There's obviously the Iran crisis, Article 5 in NATO if Russia invades a NATO country, a whole load of different things and what would happen. My initial thesis was actually Bitcoin probably sell off, which it did for a very short period of time and then rallied. And I think it's because a lot of people in Iran, according to Elliptic, are really increasing their holdings of Bitcoin now or holding Bitcoin for the first time. And it's what's really encouraging all this. We saw this happen in Ukraine. We saw a 250% rise in Bitcoin volumes in Ukraine after in February 2022. So, yeah, when there are geopolitical crises, we knew that Bitcoin tends to do quite well, just like gold has historically. But you couldn't buy gold at the weekend, but you can buy Bitcoin very easily. And it's really encouraging to actually see that come happen in real time throughout this Ryan crisis and continues to actually really outperform gold and equities, although it's recorrelated with equities a little bit in the last couple of days. But yeah, Elliptic has highlighted a big increase in wallet holdings of Bitcoin. So, but it also comes at a time when I would have thought gold would perhaps perform a bit better, but gold over the last 5 months, 9 months has massively rallied. So it's looking a bit expensive, a bit toppy. And on the conversely, Bitcoin has been smashed by whales selling. You know, we've hit various technical indicators, the RSI at 16, MVRV, that sort of valuation metric, market value over realized value, is looking like Bitcoin's looking quite cheap at the moment. So it comes at a time when, you know, Bitcoin was cheap. So it kind of made sense that it's easier for it to outperform during this geopolitical crisis than gold.
Yeah, Bitcoin's certainly looking relatively cheap to pretty much everything. You know, you talk about evaluations of stocks and things like this. And one thing I was looking at was when all this kicked off was who is more reliant on energy that comes out of that strait. The US was something like 2%. For example, we saw the KOSPI get absolutely smashed. The worst day since 2008. They're about 50% dependent on energy that comes out of that strait. And you kind of go, well, hang on, how do I hedge like individual sovereign risk? Well, we have this asset that was given to us in the midst of the 2008 financial crisis, where it kind of looked like the cracks were starting to show. And when situations like this arise, it kind of serves that lifeboat or escape out of any kind of singular sovereign nation and some of their structural issues that may come on the back end of this. And I think that's really unique and only something that's going to accelerate in a world like the one that we're in?
So I think it's done a lot to help establish Bitcoin's identity, the last week's worth of activity. I call it this emerging store of value, because I still think its identity is being established. This wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. And I think it's down to a level of understanding. There's still a lot of people that don't understand Bitcoin well. Just the other day, I was at some big Citywire event in London with 200 investors, and I told a few people I was in crypto, and they just kind of laughed. I've not experienced that for a while, actually, but there are still people like that, right? So it tells you that there's still a lot of people who don't understand Bitcoin and what its identity is and what it stands for. But it is emerging, and I think it's incredibly encouraging to see what's happened in Iran what's happened to Bitcoin with relation to what's happened in Iran.
Yeah, I think those people kind of laughing off the Bitcoin comments, or even more broadly the space as a whole, you can only but derive that they don't have an understanding of it. And I say that with as much respect as I can give to a comment such as that. I think when you really understand, and you understand the esoteric nature of this space, but when you understand what it's doing, what it offers, I think you're a fool not to understand it, or at least have spent the time doing so, because it does offer that unique diversifier as far as Bitcoin's concerned. And more broadly, I think the technology is going to do amazing things to the world. I think it's going to change the world fundamentally. I truly believe that. I think that's being signaled from lots of different aspects. But there's a lot of crap that's caught up in that, I think. And coming back to the UK, we spoke about why institutions should be interested in this. What about the likes of a country like the UK? You know, why should governments take interest in this asset?
Yeah, so I think there's been a massive credibility boost to Bitcoin when the US decided to include Bitcoin or rule Bitcoin as a strategic reserve asset. And it absolutely makes sense. If you have an excess of an asset, then actually it's worth making a strategic reserve of it. And I think the UK is one of the largest. I think it's the 15th largest holder of Bitcoin in the world. So it has an excess of this asset. So it certainly makes sense to make it a strategic reserve now. We are starting to see other governments consider that. Well, we've seen Mubadala, which is a sovereign wealth fund in Abu Dhabi. And they now own $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. We've seen the Czech government do a test trade in it. We've seen Luxembourg consider it too. So there's quite a few. We've actually seen Bhutan dig itself out of a large government debt problem through actually mining Bitcoin and using energy as an excess of energy, Bhutan, through its renewable power. And in fact, well, how do you monetize that energy? Well, Bitcoin's the perfect way of monetizing that. So it certainly makes sense for a government. And, I think it making it a strategic reserve, I'm currently writing a white paper, and it's not far being done, hoping to try and encourage the UK government to have Bitcoin as a strategic reserve. You know, do you then sell this asset immediately and liquidate it and create some cash to fund different government projects? Or do you hold on to it strategically? And I think it makes sense to hold on to it strategically, because we are in this big unknown in terms of monetary policy action. Post Bretton Woods in 1971, we moved to the kind of current central banking model. Whether that is working or not is still very much in question. Governments have huge amounts of debt right now. We don't know how that's all going to end. And in fact, so it does make sense to be holding hard assets as a kind of insurance policy of that, hold them strategically. Now, the UK government at times has held gold, quite a bit of it, and sadly sold a lot of it at exactly the wrong time. I just don't want them to make the same mistake with Bitcoin, actually. And we should consider it particularly, instead of, don't use taxpayer money to buy more Bitcoin. I don't think that would be correct. But I certainly think holding existing Bitcoin, and when we see more criminal seizures of it, then it should all be centrally managed in a strategic reserve.
Yeah, I'd love to see us, I know the UK government right now is getting a lot of heat, but I'd love to see us do some things right. And I think what you're putting forward would be a right thing to do. I mean, look at Germany and the kind of mistake that they made. I mean, maybe they're kind of gaining a little bit favor with recent price action, but they literally sold and it went straight up. And you're referring to Brown's bottom there in regards to what we did with gold, which couldn't have been better timed, quite frankly. We don't want to make the same mistake with Bitcoin, certainly given what we spoke about with this kind of institutional, perhaps sovereign avalanche.
I know you, before the meeting, you were sort of expressing a frustration about people in the government. I'm involved in some lobbying, and there are some pockets of hope.
Agreed.
Within the government, there are some people such as Sir John Glenn, who's, I think, really sees the merits of distributed ledger tech, but also Bitcoin as well. So there are people that, you know, could really, I help think, help sway and change opinion on it.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm glad you brought me down a peg there, because it is true. I say the government, I'm tarnishing a hell of a lot of people with one brush. We speak to a lot of the think tanks and people like that are involved actually in talking to governments, and they'll say the exact same thing. You've got some really receptive people that want to try and change the world for the better. It's not all perhaps what I'm portraying, which is, you know, headlines, economic data and things like that are coming off the back end of this, and frustration, I guess. So no, I'm glad you brought me down a peg in regards to that, because that is absolutely a fair comment to make, I think. What do you think about what they're doing with ETNs here in the UK? Because it seems strange, the path that they've followed thus far, and now we got a kind of win. But then I heard something the other day about them changing a rule so that actually you might not be able to buy ETNs anymore.
Well, they might change that rule again. That's still up for debate. So you can now buy Bitcoin in an ETN. So we talk about ETFs, ETNs, ETCs.
Our equivalent,
right? All of those is ETPs, actually. And there's a bit of an alphabet soup there, but ETNs are just exchange traded notes, and they're like the ETFs in the US, very, very similar structure, physically backed, etc., bankruptcy, remote assets. But ultimately, they have chosen, if you want to hold it in a SIP, then you do have to answer quite a lengthy, sophisticated investor questionnaire. For you to, and the idea is on the regulator is that that's the only kind of people it should be used for, not unsophisticated investors. But, you know, it's a bit, you know, there's double standards there, because you can buy something like a coffee ETN. Are people really experts in coffee? You know, and actually coffee has 130% annualized vol. Bitcoin has 40% annualized vol. So it's a lot more volatile asset. So there's definitely, I think, double standards there. But, you know, perhaps it comes from a rather an antiquated view in the regulator about the assets. But now they have liberalized. I mean, I think there's been a lot of pressure. It's been liberalized in the US with the ETF launches and in Europe with MiCA. And so it does feel like the UK regulator's been lagging behind. So they've allowed it now in SIPs, but also in what they call IFISAs, which, if I'm brutally honest, I had to look up when they first mentioned these. They are quite an esoteric type of ISA, and it's quite hard to get an ISA, and a lot of actually platforms in the fund platforms don't offer IF ISAs. So it's kind of, for many people who want Bitcoin in their ISAs, it's still really, or they'd have to create an IF ISA, which is a really difficult thing to do. So it hasn't really improved the situation much. There's still, I think, some ongoing lobbying on this respect, though, and it could well change before the April deadline, where people would have to, I think, move them out of ISAs and into IF ISAs. I think that may well change. So it's not a done deal with that. But that has been a lot of confusion for people and frustration for some too.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. I mean, I utilize my stocks and shares ISA as much as I can every year, because I think it's brilliant. I would like to see us be able to put, you know, crypto products in that. I understand that there's sort of certainly a kind of, what would the word be, thought around it being far more risky, so on and so forth. But when you look at the world we're in, I mean, look at how oil's trading. Look at how gold's trading. Look at how silver's trading. You know, silver, what was it, like a 30%+ move in one day?
Yeah.
I mean, what is and isn't risky now?
Yeah, it's slightly a civil liberties question as well, which I don't want to get too into.
Okay. Let's move on to some stuff around more the more broader cryptocurrency space, because of course it's not just Bitcoin flows that you guys track; it's the space more broadly. Let's talk about some winners or some interesting things that you're seeing in relation to the kind of altcoin market as far as fund flows are concerned? Are there any kind of trends that you're noticing? What's more popular? What's less? Is it market cap weighted? You know, what are some of the things you can derive from the flows we're seeing with altcoins?
So I write a sort of fund flows year end summary every year. And I think what's really interesting, just looking at stuff year on year, because it gives you a sort of step out a little bit in a big picture. You know, definitely the winner in 2024 was Bitcoin, $41 billion of inflows. It's huge. Out of the total of 47, 48 billion of inflows, it was massive, dominated. But that was quite different in 2025. Ethereum actually got off to quite a slow start. And in 2024, it saw $5 billion worth of inflows, 5.3. But then in 2025, it saw 50, what was it? No, just looking here at the data, it was $13 billion worth of inflows. Something changed. And most of that was loaded into the fourth quarter of 2025. And it's perfectly timed with the Genius and Stablecoin Acts. Suddenly, stablecoin, you know, where are most payment rails? They're on for stablecoins. They are on Ethereum and some on Tron as well, but predominantly Ethereum. And I think a lot of investors have identified that. We've not seen the commensurate price rise yet, but I think a lot of people were quite early in that, actually, and quite present in seeing that Ethereum is going to be one of the main beneficiaries of the Stablecoin and Genius Acts and the Clarity Act as well, because that's where most of the payment rails are for stablecoins. So that is really the standout performer last year in terms of fund flows. And then the other two were Solana and XRP. And I'd say, you know, less fundamentals based and perhaps more about, again, massively loaded into the fourth quarter, the flows were, well, second half. It was in anticipation of the ETF launches in the US, of spot-based ETFs, ones for Solana and XRP, and they happened in October. And there was a flood of inflows prior to that in anticipation of it and afterwards as well. So I think, you know, XRP saw a five-fold increase in inflows with $3.7 billion in 2025. And Solana saw a 10-fold increase in inflows for $3.5 billion in inflows. So both assets, you know, have done incredibly well relative to the size of their market cap as well. But stepping outside of that, we've seen a decline in flows. So if you look at all other altcoins except for the big four, like I've just mentioned, we saw in 2024, we saw $500 million of inflows. So much, much smaller than the $41 billion into Bitcoin, which shows you the participation in altcoins is still very low, but it declined in 2025. So we saw, I think, just 300 million of inflows into other altcoins. So there's very, very little participation yet in other altcoins. Now, it's partly an access thing because most people in America can't buy ETFs, spot-based ETFs in all these other altcoins yet. And that's why whenever you see the SEC, there are quite a few and people have submitted the SEC, but nothing else has been launched yet. But I think when the next inclusion, the next approval by the SEC, you'll probably see a flood of inflows into whatever asset is approved. But at the moment, so when I talk about those flows in other altcoins, I'm primarily talking about the activity in Europe, which has been, you know, there hasn't been that appetite. And the other interesting thing is multi-asset funds. So that is the top five crypto or top 10. And those baskets have not performed well. I think for a while there was this idea, like if you look at the FTSE 100, a basket of the top 100 stocks, the idea was safety in numbers. You buy the FTSE 100, the volatility is lower. It represents a whole mixture of different things. But that's completely the opposite in crypto. You've seen the volatility is much higher in baskets than it is in, say, Bitcoin or Ethereum on its own. And I think it reflects that it's still very much an emergent asset class and there's a lot of volatility in these other assets.
Kind of conversation that you're having in regards to investors, you know, when you talk about Solana, XRP, who's typically investing in that?
Well, let's be clear, like there's a race to bottom commercially in ETFs in terms of fees. So it doesn't make sense for us to be selling a load of Bitcoin anymore at 15 basis points when we could sell something, an altcoin, at 200 basis points or 150 basis points in terms of fees. But it's important actually in research that I'm truthful with the clients in terms of where I see the opportunities are. And I think for us, you know, there's obviously this commercial prerogative to talk more about altcoins, but I do think there's Bitcoin is really important as an asset just for, you know, geopolitical hedge, monetary policy hedge, etc. And it's almost like the gateway into other digital assets, potentially. I don't see anyone saying, yeah, I'm loading up with Hyperliquid before I've ever bought Bitcoin. So I think we see it as a kind of gateway into other altcoins. But it's very important, I think, certainly because of my background, you know, when I make investments, I'm a very much fundamentals-based investor. I don't look at charts and say, oh, there's a head and shoulders forming here, and therefore I'm buying. I try to create a fundamental investment thesis behind the asset that I'm investing in. And, you know, I think a lot of our clients have a similar approach, that kind of a more institutional level approach to investing. And so if we are to talk about other altcoins, I think it's got to have a really sound investment thesis behind it. And I think Ethereum is very easy to talk about. You talk about, you know, the stablecoin industry is $300 billion today. Scott Bessent thinks it's going to be $2 trillion by 2028. So there's huge growth in that. Ethereum's clearly going to benefit from that. So that, and then when you step outside of that, I think it's more about what are the real world revenues it could create or create. So Hyperliquid is a really good example of that. You know, Hyperliquid versus XRP. Well, it's slightly different, but Hyperliquid is obviously this online trading platform that is sometimes trading $1 billion a day and trading in real world assets. Like it did $1.2 billion in gold and silver alone in one day in February. So amazing. So that is demonstrating real world usage. It also has this quite credible value accrual mechanism. So when there are significant revenues generated through trading from Hyperliquid, it is reflected in the burn mechanism of Hype. And so there is this connection between Hype, the asset, and the success of Hyperliquid. There isn't, by the way, in XRP, in my view. There is no value accrual mechanism behind the success of Ripple and XRP and it being reflected in that token. So that's what I mean when I talk about, I think these assets have to have a fundamental investment case to warrant, you know, us speaking to clients about them. So firstly, I mean, I think clients are like, they're still, for many clients, it's very early days. Bitcoin with a little bit of Ethereum now, is very adventurous to step into something like a liquid or something. A Hyperliquid or something like that. But we're talking about the big theme for this year has been hybrid finance. So this is where we're seeing the crypto world and the TradFi world combine. And that the combination of the two is that hybrid finance. And I think since the Genius and Stablecoin Acts have passed through Congress, that we've seen people a much better, a much more solid investment thesis for some of these altcoins, like Hyperliquid being one. You know, if you look at BlackRock, Biddle, for instance, obviously that is a hybrid finance type business now. And, you know, if I look at the assets it's going into, Aptos, it's obviously on Ethereum and a range of others, it's decided to list its real world assets on. That's where I think there's a really compelling thing. So you've got those payment rails, Sui, Say, Ethereum, a range of them for stable coins. You have real world assets, obviously BlackRock Biddle is a good example and the different platforms it's using. And then you have these on-chain assets making real world revenue, such as Hyperliquid, Uniswap and others. And so that is, I think, certainly like from a company kind of strategic ETF when we're looking at the ETFs we want to launch, they're the kind of, that's the approach we're taking. We're not taking the machine gun approach like some of our competitors are taking. Some of our competitors have 70 different crypto. That, you know, they have Dogecoin. We would be highly unlikely for us to launch a Dogecoin because it has massive inflation and absolutely zero investment thesis, other than it being a meme coin. You could say, well, you can invest in memes. But I think that's hard. You can't sell that to an institutional investor. So, that's the approach we're taking. Just kind of a level-headed kind of fundamental investment thesis towards altcoins.
Yeah, no, I think that's the right approach, certainly as all this unfolds. 2026, it seems like, it's only March and so much has happened this year thus far. How do you kind of see the remainder of this year playing out as a kind of final question? You know, what's on your kind of bingo card in regards to 2026 as it relates to the crypto space and certainly funds?
There's my core view, and then there's these kind of satellite kind of tail risk events. And there's a lot of tail risk events that I think warrant holding something like Bitcoin and Ethereum. So, Bitcoin in particular, you know, there's yen carry trade collapse that could happen. Russia could invade a NATO country. Trump being impeached, that's not totally out of the world. I think Polymarket put that at 15-20% occurrence in 2026. So it could happen. There's lots of different things. And I think for the majority of those tail risks, Bitcoin sells off, but then it recovers quite sharply as people see from, particularly if it's something like Russia invoking Article 5 or yen carry trade collapse, suddenly non-traditional assets look quite attractive. You know, we'd already seen that. We've seen yields rise during this current geopolitical crisis. So people abandoning treasuries. And what do they buy instead? Well, they're considering Bitcoin. And certainly, if you look at the price action, although it's quite muted, it's quite encouraging to see that. So there's those. And then there's the core views. I think there's a long-term political support, particularly for things like Ethereum. The Clarity Act will eventually be passed. And if it doesn't include stablecoin yields in the Clarity Act, it will eventually, I think. And that will threaten the existing banking system and be hugely beneficial for Ethereum. And then there's Bitcoin, which, step outside of the geopolitics, I think it's, you know, we're at the end, tail end of this cycle that I talked about earlier. And it's looking quite attractive right now. And we're also on the path, I think, to looser monetary policy in the long term. Now, rising oil prices kind of slow that thesis down because, you know, if you look at the probability of a rate cut in June now, it's quite low. I think that's going to change, actually. I think we had a very grim employment payrolls data last Friday, you know, minus 92, and I think the consensus was plus 60. So that's really quite a big miss. And that will probably pressure the Fed into cutting rates. And, you know, just more broadly, though, we continue to see across the world M2 money supply continue to rise. And Bitcoin's dislocated from that. And either Bitcoin's got it right and actually money supply is going to really contract, or actually Bitcoin investors got it wrong and there's this actually quite a good opportunity now to take advantage of this market dislocation. And Bitcoin's going to snap back to that strong performance that M2 has alluded to. And I do think that will happen in the second half of this year. I think we'll see an increasingly dovish MPC or the Fed in the US and MPC in the UK too. And that, I think, will support the Bitcoin in the longer term.
Yeah, and assets more broad. It's going to be interesting to see how markets do like to test a new Fed chair. It's going to be interesting to see, is he going to get in line or is he not? I mean, monetary policy doesn't make sense to me at the moment with sort of inflation where it's at as far as CPI is concerned, where monetary policy is at. I also understand they need room for events like the one that we're currently going through and how that may affect things. There is definitely a negative correlation with oil and markets going all the way back to the oil embargo from Saudi Arabia back in 1973, I think, and how that affected things. And if history is anything to go by, could be a volatile year, which is typically the second year of the president's cycle, right?
Kevin Warsh I was surprised he was hired because I had thought, I was convinced it would be Kevin Hassett, who's quite a dove, quite an extreme dove. And then we had this possibility of Rick Reeder from BlackRock. And I thought that was quite a possibility too. And I just thought, well, Trump, you know, always wants a dove. And then it was really surprising to see Kevin Warsh. But also, I think actually Trump had done himself a disservice. He had decided to take the Fed to court. And actually, that really cemented the hawks in the Fed. So if he'd installed his own dove, it would have been a lame duck dove in many respects. So there's very quite limited on what he could really do and how he could influence monetary policy. But, you know, Warsh is known, you know, through his tenure from 2006 to 2011 as a Fed member, he was quite hawkish on inflation, way more hawkish than other people. So we know that about him. He's going to think less about the employment picture and more about inflation. And so I think the market's got it right about their skeptical rate cuts coming anytime soon in the next 3 or 4 months at least.
Wasn't he against QE in 2008? Wasn't that a thing? Wasn't he against a lot of the sort of QE that took place in 2008?
That I can't remember.
I'd heard that as a verified, and I'm thinking, well, hang on, this isn't the dove that maybe people want, you know? So yeah.
Yeah, so we're at risk of, I think, you know, being in continual disappointment of further Fed rate cuts this year with Kevin Warsh. So maybe he will continue. I mean, certainly now with what's happened to oil, it slightly depends on how sustained the oil price is at these current levels. But definitely that would be used as an excuse now to hold off on any rate cuts for now.
It's going to be an interesting year, that's for sure. James, it's been an absolute pleasure. Where can we send people? People are going to want to know more about yourself. They're going to want to know more about CoinShares. Where can we send them?
I suppose your blog.coinshares.com and coinshares.com/research, the two places where we tend to articulate our views.
Yep. And ladies and gentlemen, I personally look, and I'm not just saying this because I've got James in front of me, every single Monday, those of you that watch my daily market updates will know that I look at this report every single Monday. I personally use this report. I think it's very insightful, very helpful, needed, brilliantly put together. And it's been an absolute pleasure and honor to have you on the show and to be able to talk to you, James. So thanks for coming on. We hope to have you on soon.
Thanks for having me.